I podcast to understand, not to be understood. Now, when you listen to the rest of this episode, I want you to remember that little slogan and keep it in mind. This is one of two special Newton Talks episodes on the 25th Eon-produced James Bond film, No Time to Die. This episode you're listening to now is a reactions episode where I've got some special guests, Lee Kenny, Will Hill, and Chris Deasy, who are going to be joining me to talk about their initial reactions to No Time to Die. I'll also be giving you my thoughts on the film too. The other episode is a more in-depth discussion with New Zealand-based journalist Lee Kenny, who, like myself, is also a massive James Bond fan. Please listen to that once you've finished here. Now, it goes without saying that there's going to be spoilers here. It's a very spoiler-heavy episode. So if you haven't seen No Time to Die and you don't want to hear any spoilers, then please switch off. Although if you haven't seen the film, I don't know what you're listening to this for. Now, the reason why I made that little statement at the start of the episode is because I'm a bit nervous about seeming too negative about a film. I know how difficult it is to produce movies, and I think there's too much negativity in the world, particularly around pop culture, and it can be a little bit tiresome. Nevertheless, some elements of these reactions do sway towards being negative, but I can promise you it's well thought out, it's considered, and in many respects, we're just free thinking here, processing our thoughts, processing our ideas. Before I introduce my guests, I think I'll give my reaction to the film. I've been a Bond fan from a very early age. It was some of the first films I ever went to see at the cinema, but I really became a fan around the age of about 10, 11 years old, when I picked up a load of old James Bond paperback novels from the flea market at the Birmingham Bullring. Some bloke was selling them for about 5p each. And I think I picked up all of the novels at that point, apart from The Spy Who Loved Me and Casino Royale. So, and I've been reading those books now for a long, long time, and I always see them as companion pieces to the film. They interplay between each other. The books enhance the movies, and the movies enhance the books, even if that's not the way that they're supposed to be intended. Now, generally, I'm quite cool on the Daniel Craig James Bond films. I really want to like them more than I do. I think Casino Royale is great. But there are elements of the Daniel Craig films where it just seems as if they're being made by people who don't actually like the franchise and are almost embarrassed by it. The lack of the James Bond theme used in any triumphant way is an example of that. It's almost as if the filmmakers don't like what's gone before. Which is fine. Things need to move on. Things need to develop. And one thing the Daniel Craig Bond films have done is they've taken the character very seriously and they've tried to invest it with some real quality. Most people would claim that something like No Time to Die is better than a film such as The Man with the Golden Gun in terms of the acting, in terms of the effects, in terms of the production design, etc., etc. But I don't think it's as good. My own personal top five James Bond films would be something like, although it does fluctuate, would be probably Dr. No, The Living Daylights, The Spy Who Loved Me, Casino Royale and On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And depending on when you ask me, you could probably put License to Kill and Octopussy in the top five too. So generally I'm quite cold on the Daniel Craig films. I certainly like them. But in my ranking of all the 25 James Bond films, 27 if we include the 1967 Casino Royale and Never Say Never Again, I would put them near the bottom end of the list, with the exception of Casino Royale, which I would conversely put near the very, very top. So let's have a quick assessment of No Time to Die. Well, I wasn't looking forward to the film. I didn't like Spectre. I put that right at the bottom. I didn't like the fact that they were doubling down on what they did in Spectre. I'd heard some rumours about what the film was going to do in terms of the plotline. Not happy with Madeline coming back. I'd heard about the kid. I wasn't happy with that. The whole thing seemed to be an unnecessary sequel to Spectre. That worst was coming 6 years after Spectre was made. So, you know, it was building on something that most people would have forgotten, I would think. But watching it, the first hour of No Time to Die, I really very much enjoyed. I think that's quite a common assessment. He packs Madeline off at the end of the pre-title sequence. Superb. It's unfortunate we know that she's going to come back, but you know, when she's out of the picture, the film really lifts. So the pre-title sequence is good, some really great stunts, some really good use of the Aston Martin. I never want to see it again, really, but it's certainly good use of the Aston Martin. The Billie Eilish song works well in context with another great credit sequence, Daniel Kleiman. I love the stuff in Jamaica with Felix Leiter. The scenes in Cuba work. They're not great action scenes, but they're quite bizarre. There's really, I think the character of Paloma is a fun character. I think the conceit of having Blofeld's robotic eye being paraded around on a cushion was really fun and really outlandish and really over the top in the best Bondian tradition. And so despite some dramatic moments, such as Felix dying, which is really, I didn't enjoy, but you could tell where the film was going after they did that. The film moves in the first hour. The action's pretty good. And we get to see Bond just hanging out, fishing, driving into town, drinking with Felix. And honestly, some of these moments from No Time to Die are up there with the best Bond scenes of all time. I don't like the second half of the film. I don't like it when it goes back to London. It really does run out quite dramatically. The second Blofeld dies, really. That's the point where it really tanks for me. The film relies on some spectacular sentiment that really does drag. And overall, the film tries to do too much. The ending where Bond dies doesn't work for me. It doesn't feel triumphant. It doesn't feel like an ultimate sacrifice. And generally, it didn't feel very impressive. But all of that could be forgiven because most James Bond films have a poor second half in relation to the first. If you can find a James Bond film that's got a brilliant last 45 minutes, that tends to be one of the best ones, I find. But No Time to Die is undercut by a real mawkishness. As a friend of mine said in an email to me, music shouldn't well up in a spy film. But you get that happening here way too much. And after the first time I watched it, I saw it on opening night and I was booked in to see it the first thing the next morning. And I really didn't want to go the second time. And the second time, I really hated it. So my overall feelings towards the film for a long time were very, very negative. However, as we know, as Bond fans, these things tend to shift around a little bit. And by the time I watched the film for the third time, I did feel a lot better about it. So I feel a lot more kind towards the movie now than I did after the opening weekend. At the moment, I'd probably put this film in my bottom five, possibly one above Spectre. I do think it's a huge improvement on Spectre, by the way. A huge improvement. Massively better than Spectre. But I still put it right near the bottom of the list. But who knows where it'll be in a year's time, 5 years' time, 10 years' time. With these things, as soon as the next Bond film comes out, I tend to feel a lot kinder about the previous one. So that's my general thoughts of it. Certainly a brilliantly made film. Certainly a film that has some wonderful moments. But he's really let down by this cloying sentimentality and a feeling that it's far more serious and special than it actually is. That was my assessment. Let's get some of my guests in. The first guest is Lee Kenny, a New Zealand-based journalist who is a huge James Bond fan. Lee.
You're in New Zealand, so I think you saw it a few weeks after the rest of the world. What were your initial thoughts of No Time to Die when you first saw it?
Well, James, I loved it. You're right. I think we received it here in cinemas about a week afterwards. So I'd managed to avoid any spoilers. And I booked the day off work, as is a bit of a tradition I have with the Bond films. I went to the first screening, 10 o'clock in the morning. It was just me and about a dozen pensioners in a big theatre. And I enjoyed it immensely. Now, it's a highly emotional film. And I guess as someone that's quite heavily invested in the Bond films, it definitely did. What can I say? Well, I mean, there was certainly, I'll go so far as to say there were times when I was welling up, James. I was, you know, that's how surprisingly emotional it was. Within the first few minutes, when they played the score from Honor Majesty's Secret Service, I felt like that just floored me. And I don't know whether that's my age or perhaps a bit of homesickness, because as you mentioned, I'm in New Zealand. Or whether it was just something that just worked really to hear that John Barry score on the big screen. I think overall it was the perfect swan song for Daniel Craig's Bond tenure.
So was there any reticence at all, like there was to me, to any of the emotional stuff? Because like I think me and you are very different. Even though we're big James Bond fans, we've got very different viewpoints on what we like and what we don't like. Did you have any like hang-ups at all by any of the revelations in the film?
The biggest problems I've had more recently with the Bond films is the Blofeld brother revelation in Spectre, which is almost unforgivable, really. So by comparison, I don't think these were nearly as offensive, if you like. Now, definitely it was a shock to see James Bond die. That's obviously never happened before. And I didn't know that, although I had kind of read, I'd read a few spoiler things prior to the film's release, because there was obviously such a long delay. I didn't know about that. There was obviously kind of talk about the possibility of Bond dying. I didn't think that they would kind of go to those lengths. So it was a surprise when he kind of reaches that point. I guess narratively, if you do kind of buy into the fact that, you know, he does have a daughter now, I guess kind of narratively it made sense. Like, he was the only person that was kind of carrying the nanobots in his system that could have potentially led to the death of his lover and his daughter, so therefore kind of had no choice but to kind of take the ultimate heroic act and let himself die on the island. But I mean, that was certainly a shock, but I didn't mind the fact that he had a daughter, and I say definitely by comparison it was not as offensive as Blofeld being his brother.
I'd read some things where the death was a blessed relief, basically, after what I suspected they could have done. Like, that was the best outcome, basically. Because we were hearing all sorts of things about clones, and I'd seen some people on YouTube when they talked about no spoiler reviews of it, who'd been at the premiere, and they were talking about things, routes they go down, and I was thinking, maybe Bond was dead and they bring him back as a clone, or the daughter was a clone, or the fact that he died in Spectre and he's just been a clone in no time to die, whatever it's been. I mean, your mind goes to ridiculous lengths, but none of them as ridiculous as Blofeld being his half-brother and some of the other stuff that they did. But so I'm glad you enjoyed it. Where would you rank it? Last question. Where would you rank it in relation to Daniel Craig's James Bond and the rest of the James Bond films? If you have to put it kind of high ranking, mid ranking, low ranking, where would you put it?
I would say it's the fourth most enjoyable Daniel Craig film. So I would go Casino Royale, Skyfall, Quantum of Solace, No Time to Die, and Spectre. And in terms of, it certainly wouldn't be top 15. I mean, there are moments though. There are moments when the film is beautiful. It's so beautifully shot. Some really good standout scenes, which would be up there with some of the best. But as an overall film, no, it wouldn't be top 10 for me.
That was Lee Kenny. And if you want to hear more from Lee, please listen to my other episode on No Time to Die, where me and Lee talk about the film in a lot more detail and have a more in-depth discussion. Okay, so next I've got Dr. Chris Deasy, a reader in theology and religious studies at the University of Kent. Chris.
So you are the world's number one cinema goer, right? I think that's every single night of the week.
My silence, James, is because I'm not disagreeing with you.
So I don't know anyone who goes to the cinema as much as you do. So you are my source for all films that have come out in the last 10 years, really. And also don't know anybody who's seen No Time to Die as much as you have either. And especially since the fact that you're not like myself. I would call myself a James Bond fanatic. You're probably not that, but you're a movie fan, clearly. But you really like this film, more so than even my big James Bond friends.
Well, this is interesting because after watching No Time to Die, and I have to say I have indeed watched it 007 times. Actually, I watched it 5 and then thought, just 2 more, and then that's my epitaph. It's a bit like all those... I'm a big fan of all those early 90s thrillers like The Fugitive in the Line of Fire, because then the action undergirds the character, and that isn't normally the case in a Bond film. But this film blew me away, because I genuinely didn't expect to watch it or plan to watch it 7 times, but I found that there were nuances there and a melodrama which, you know, understandably for people who are really keen on particular facets of the Bond film, this plays with those conventions, so it's bound to be divisive. But I actually thought that in watching this, I felt emotionally pulled in, and I can't think of any other Bond film where that has happened.
So it's interesting what you say about the emotional storytelling, in that maybe the previous, the old James Bond films, that would be something that maybe alienated you slightly. So how did it go after the pre-title sequence? What where when you were watching for the first time, can you remember what you were feeling at that point?
Yes. Well, the pre-credit sequence is 25 minutes.
Yes, long.
And actually, when it then comes, it's quite jarring. And on each occasion, I was sensitive to what other people in the audience might be thinking, because I think on one occasion, somebody sort of jolted and like, oh, you know, I'd forgotten that we hadn't seen this already. Because that must be a record. I think leaving Las Vegas, I remember seeing that at the cinema back in the mid-90s. And I think then the credits come on after at least 20 minutes. But it's quite jarring when that happens.
There's a Monty Python episode where they put the opening titles about 20 minutes into the it reminds me a little bit of that kind of thing.
Yeah. But it also says something about the pacing of this film, because it's 25 minutes in, but it's a 2 hour and 43, I think, minute film. So in a funny way, in proportion, it works. Because it was one of the films I saw after watching Bond, because there was a period of like nothing but Bond showing. And I saw the Venom film, Let There Be Carnage. And that is almost half the length. It's not even an hour and a half, and yet that zips through it. But I was lost. I was disinterested after half an hour. I thought there was too much going on, in a way that the Bond film took its time, and that's what I felt after watching the credit sequence. That I felt that I was sufficiently hooked, and it was a throwback as well to, you know, with the use of the what sounded like the John Barry score. And the All the Time in the World from On Her Majesty's Secret Service. It felt that it was a very careful attempt to try and remind us, perhaps in ways that perhaps some of the other, I thought anyway, Daniel Craig films didn't do, what made Bond so great for an earlier generation. I mean, I was talking to my mother not long ago, who isn't a Bond film fan at all, but she did see, I think it was Goldfinger at the cinema with a friend back in the mid-60s. And so that's her entry point, and I don't think she knows much that's happened since the mid-60s. So in a funny way, I could imagine that if she were to watch this film, there might be something in there that would connect with her in a way that I can't imagine would have happened with Quantum of Solace, for example. There was one bit when I was trying to work out, is she the Madeleine Swan, is she, she's the daughter of a Spectre agent. But I was also trying to work out then, because the young girl at the beginning obviously is her. Mm-hmm. But while I was watching, I was going through all these different scenarios, and not having seen Spectre as well, it must be said. So at one point, I was thinking, hang on a minute, is her father James Bond, or is the father Blofeld? And obviously, as you watch the film, it's obvious that it's neither of those. But not having seen Spectre, I was trying to work out how her own father was both the villain of the piece, an agent to, you know, working for Blofeld or whatever, but also then she has a child with James Bond. And after the first viewing, all of these ideas were muddled in my head, and I needed to process them. But also, I haven't seen a Daniel Craig Bond film since Quantum of Solace, and that was well over a decade ago. So in that sense, I was watching this quite aware that there were lots of gaps. Even Spectre, I wasn't quite sure who. I thought, who is Spectre? Is a son? You're a daughter of Spectre? Then I realised it's the organisation. So it's things like that that, just as somebody who's perhaps a relative novice compared to you, needed to work through. But I felt that in watching the film a second time, I was able to fill in these gaps. I mean, the Marvel films are often very good. I don't take to those really very well, but they're often good at creating their own mythology. But with the Bond film, there's a clear canon that's 60 years old. But this film felt like a very fresh take on that. But the pacing, I think, is key to that, because all the action, all the sequences make sense in the context of, for example, at the beginning. It's a good 15-20 minutes before anything remotely action-based happens, unless you count the scene on the ice, which is done very, very slowly and carefully. And it's the scene when he's sort of run over on the bridge after mourning his previous girlfriend, Vespa. And again, you sort of see his anger, that he's there mourning. He's undertaking a very personal, you know, ritual, a death ritual. He's mourning a past lover. And then somebody's taking advantage of that and exploiting the fact that he's going to be there to mourn, to try and get rid of him. So you feel that sense of outrage. It's not just, as in some of the other films, he's just doing his job. And it's like, who's the enemy? Oh, well, we'll find out later. And it's just going through the motions. Here, what was shocking is the fact that there was a real taboo, something very sacred, if you like, being breached.
Let's go back to this idea, just to kind of wrap it up, this idea of the melodrama and the sentimentality, because this is the stuff that really alienated me, particularly in this film. There's elements of it that I really liked, that were really quite affecting, but by the end it's laid on very thick, I think it has to be said. Um, Was there any element of you that you think they pushed it a little bit too far in terms of the sentimentality, in terms of scene after scene after scene, or were you really strung along and pulled along with this?
Yeah, no, I was pulled along, but what was interesting is that you see all the faces of anybody. You have Q and you have M and you have Mallory, who is M. Q and M and Mallory, and you have all the, and the other 007, and of course his wife, or no, his wife is the mother of his child.
Yeah.
All looking in a, you know, they know what's happening, and it dawns on them that actually this is the end of Bond. It's the end of an era, really, for them. And the mourning that you see at the beginning when he goes to Vesper's grave, I think, is then counted at the end. And it kind of all fits. I mean, this is the thing that really worked, because at the very beginning, of course, he says, as they're driving, you know, with Bond and Mallory, he says, "We have all the time in the world." And of course, you're thinking, "Ah, that's the Louis Armstrong song." But then you see that that is integrated, you know, the whole issue of having time or not having time. To have that kind of almost existential thinking going on in a Bond film, because normally, you know, they're very funny to watch, and I always liked the Roger Moore ones because you kind of knew what you expected. They knew that they were silly, and the quips were always very funny. They were daft, but you, within the context of what it is that worked, you couldn't transplant the Roger Moore Bond to what you have here. But and I think Daniel Craig in that sense stepped up. I actually think that in the earlier ones that he did, if anything, he was too young for the role, because I was used to seeing a more, you know, Sean Connery, as he was quite young when he started, but Roger Moore was well into his 40s when he took on the role of Bond, and the Bond films that I grew up with were when he was well into his 50s. So Daniel Craig was a younger generation, and that's fine, but I kind of felt in this film there was far more depth and more of a backstory, because the age of, you know, somebody, there was a very wistfulness to this film, which I don't think the Daniel Craig from Casino Royale could have played in that sense. I think that what was important here is the sense that he's somebody who's been around for a long time, and there's a sense of nostalgia, sentiment, reflection in his life, which I just didn't get out of those earlier Daniel Craig films. So it kind of came at the right moment. And it's kind of ironic, because I would say it's the best Bond film, but I didn't think that much of Daniel Craig in the other films that he did. So it's like, it's the best Bond film, but it's in that sense, on lots of levels for me, just atypical.
Chris, thanks very much for giving me your thoughts. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure, James.
So I'm here with Will Hill, who's a lecturer in media at Canterbury Christchurch University and a comic book writer himself. Will, you're sort of an on-off James Bond fan, sort of casual fan. You like the Bond fans, but you're not a fanatic. You watched No Time to Die last night. What were your thoughts?
As a piece of entertainment, I enjoyed it. I think it is a competent, well-made movie. Like, there's no doubt about that. I think shots, sequences look stunning. Like, it's a beautiful to look at movie. I think, obviously, and we'll probably discuss this the most, and most people are discussing this the most, is the ending, and where that obviously leaves the franchise and what that does to Bond, and the idea that obviously it's in some way having to cement Daniel Craig as what he's brought to the role, and giving it that kind of, I don't know, a gravitas that perhaps it wasn't required. It's really like, this was my era, whereas everyone else has sort of bowed out, either because contracts haven't been renewed or they know that they were a bit too old. There's no uplift, there's no reason to come out of this like punching the air of like, yes, he saved the day and he's done it in this great way. It was not even done in a tragedy enough way of kind of going like, he's like, it was just the last 15 minutes of Owen, but like, it was hinted from the off, certainly with the bookending of the song, and giving, you know, you thinking of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. But it just felt, amongst the plot and the thin MacGuffins and my issue comes is, and we've discussed this at length, of where, what happened after Bourne Identity, what happens after the Dark Knight trilogy, in this kind of idea of having to have one big long story. And And in the same way, I've got issues with the Star Wars trilogy. It does the things that Star Wars does, where it's like, this is your big baddie. We've decided the new person has an issue with that big baddie. Let's get rid of him and do this one instead. Where you're like, I think most people, my issue with Blofeld in Spectre is the family dynamic relationship that I'm not expecting. And that feels to really undermine other like series and stories. So there must have been a better, clever way of sort of dealing with that, and then having him as the new big baddie and continuing, because his performance is great and the Hannibal Lecter scene is interesting and I quite like that. But to then go, actually, you need another baddie who you don't care as much about, and it isn't... I'm not saying his performance is bad, I'm just not as interested. And they don't deliver... I mean, he's only in it sort of three times. Again, bookended at the beginning, and I quite like that opening scene. Then he pops up in the middle and he seems to have the weird fascination with her. But again, there's stuff where you're playing with the amount of kind of set pieces, making sure that they're in because you're Bond. But let's have serious and emotional ties. But you go, it just raises questions. What's their relationship like? So he saved her and he's fascinated and he's obsessed with her. Why hasn't he spent more time with her? So what did he do? Save her from the ice and just dump her? Like, why hasn't he been observing her? Why? Where's he been? Like, she doesn't recognise him, so at no point in saving her did he take the mask off. He just left her, did a runner, but he's fascinated. Like, those kind of things where we could realise why it's a real secret that she can't share this with Bond. And it kept going, like, she's the key to all of this because she knows things. And again, Bond is a kind of... You don't mind mistakes happening when it's pulpy and throwaway. But when you're suddenly being told this is very serious... Why is she allowed to see Blofeld? Why is she the only person in 5 years who's allowed to do that? But she's got a daughter elsewhere in a different country. Who's looking after her if she's some like secret? Why?
Because if that daughter lives in London and she took a daughter away, how come the daughter doesn't speak English?
Well, again, and this raises things where it's a real concern. And I think this is a problem with the Daniel Craig era. Bond's super skill for Daniel Craig is that he rides motorbikes. In every Daniel Craig movie, he rides a motorbike and does a stunt on a bike. Yeah, he's very good at it. But Bond,
three of them.
But Bond could ski, could scuba dive, could jump out of planes, could play cards. He plays cards in Casino Royale. Like, but you want, I don't know. I get they've dropped a lot of things. Again, perhaps this is the pulp old way of thinking, but. As a spy, I would like Bond to be able to talk a few different languages. And they're trying to do this thing of Bond being more emotional. But he can't communicate with his daughter. But at the time, he doesn't know it's his daughter. But just say, like, I think he might mutter a couple of, like, very basic phrases in French. And is that because he's intimidated by her? Or is it because he can't... Daniel Craig's Bond doesn't speak French. And I think... That's the thing, they try to make this much more rounded, more emotional, like he's torn between his feelings more, but then it's like the fundamentals of, if he is a spy travelling around the world, perhaps showcase some of those points, if you're going to make it realistic.
He doesn't do a lot, Daniel Craig, apart from hit people.
No, he's very punchy.
And I think that's fine. And it's quite good, right? And some of those are the best bits. Mm. But this is a problem. We'll go right back to Quantum of Solace. One of the reasons why I didn't like it, I think, because it's an hour and 40-minute film. There's a good 20 minutes they could have had of him playing a card game, of him playing backgammon, of him playing bridge, of having dinner with the villain. Or just adding those scenes into it would have actually, ironically, given the film a bit more pace because it would have been less relentless.
I know you're not into computer games, but it's interesting. I don't know if you know the series, but Metal Gear Solid.
I've heard of it and I've read about it since listening to the because apparently there's some plot similarities between Metal Gear Solid.
There
and
is, Andy's. So in not necessarily like the first one that was back in the '80s, but the first big release that was on PlayStation 1, you play a character called Solid Snake, and if you complete the game, you can wear a tuxedo, and there's lots and lots of homages throughout. But one of the big things in that game, right towards the end, before you meet the big baddie, is this almost endless shooting machine gun up this stairwell.
Right.
Then you get to sort of Metal Gear Solid 4, and there's this virus that gets transmitted across from contact with people, and there's the dilemma of the main person. person sort of having said virus. So the, it does seem in some ways, who knows if the writers are aware of that Metal Gear had homaged and paid tribute to, and then vice versa. But there is this thing as well, as you're sort of alluding to there, with in his bullishness and his sort of relentless, almost like Terminator-esque presence, and like certainly in the opening credits, and he just sort of stands and looks at the guns like coming towards him, but like the way they're just zipping past, you know, like he's
one hits him in the shoulder,
one hits and he just does it, does nothing. There's no and then he's got the scene in the car, which I like, where he's sort of weighing his options up. And again, there's he's because he is in this Bond, he's just driven by pure emotion. He's sort of snapping, and there is no kind of rationale of going like, oh, I've just been tricked, which you would think perhaps there'd be that kind of cognitive thought process going on. He just doesn't seem to have it. But then, because quite a few times within the film where there is this, these shootouts, and he is just standing it, like the misty horror kind of scene with the Land Rovers after him.
Yeah.
Again, just sort of taking it as they're zipping past him. When that shot at the end finally happens, it almost is unbelievable, because you're like, well, they don't hit him. And then the standoff between the two, and there's been this whole thing about the flower gardens, but then it's nanobots, and you're like, well, what was necessarily the point with all the exposition with the flowers and the foxgloves? So was that just the catalyst for his interest in doing, like, but he doesn't make them, because he's got that from bad organization who's left my head.
Spectre.
Yeah. And you're like, so it's that all feels clunky. And
yeah, I mean, some of that flower stuff's taken from the novel You Only Live Twice. So the problem with the film is it's a sort of adaptation of You Only Live Twice, but not really. So they kind of I may as well be crude, spunk these ideas from the novel straight into the and they just kind of land in the film with no real sense of why they should be there. There's absolutely no reason why you should have that flower garden as well. That is a hangover specifically from the novel of You Only Twice, when it's Blofeld living on a Japanese island, and he's surrounded by all these poisonous plants, and people go there to commit suicide because they know that it's such a dangerous place, and he's living there on his own with Irma Bunt, who's his partner, who killed Bond's wife in the previous book, Not Her Majesty's Secret Service. But they just throw that in here. And of course, it's not Blofeld who's living on the island, it's Safin who's living on the island. I mean, the whole thing could have been improved vastly by having Blofeld escape. It's a bit hokey, but Blofeld escapes in the 5 years intervening period, and he's gone missing, and he's living on this Japanese island. And then that would have worked. Safin doesn't help.
No.
He's a good performance, and I quite like him as a good villain, but I don't really know what his plan is. It wasn't clear to me. The countdown is a bit false, because even if they don't blow up the island, they've still got time to blow up the ships that are going to take Heracles. There's a bit at the end where they're talking, every bloody spy action scene now has to have people talking to each other in other rooms, right, in some control room, right? It kills Mission Impossible. It's starting to kill James Bond, as far as I can see, these fucking earpieces. And they're talking about the Americans and the Japanese and the Russians, I don't know what's going on. Well, we'll fucking tell them. Fucking tell them there's this disease that's going to kill half the planet if we don't blow this up. That'll help. do you know what I mean? And it's like, the only reason why they want to keep it quiet, as far as I can tell, is because M was the one who invented this virus or encouraged the manufacturing of the virus. And I know Safin's changed it, that Valdo character's changed it to make it kill anybody who's got the DNA. But do you see what I mean? It's a real false countdown. This isn't like a nuclear bomb's going to go off at midday, right? Or whatever it is. You get no real sense of the immediate danger here.
No.
And so they have to invent the highly illogical and implausible scenario that he can't possibly touch Madeline or Matilda ever again, or touch anybody at all, because it might eventually go get to them. They have to invent that, because the conclusion's simply not strong enough.
In any of the books, does Bond dies in war? No.
He doesn't officially die in any of them.
No.
And so at the end of From Russia With Love, he gets poisoned by Rosa Klebb, the older, you know, the spike out of the shoe, right? So he gets poisoned with that, and he slips into unconsciousness, but then he just resurrects. He doesn't, it's not officially dead, he just, that was the intention. A bit like, you know,
not quite the same as the Sherlock Holmes thing when he goes over the waterfall. Yeah. Exactly, but it's that kind of thing. It's not explained that he's dead, so he just slips into unconsciousness. And then the next book, he's just been in hospital for 6 months, Dr. Now. At the end of No Time to Die, we get the quote, I won't waste my days trying to prolong them quote, that's the M's eulogy to Bond at the very end of No Time to Die. And that quote is in the obituary for Bond in You Only Live Twice. But of course, in You Only Live Twice, we know Bond's not dead. M thinks he's dead. But we as readers know Bond isn't dead. Right, he's got amnesia, he's living on a Japanese island, but we know he's not dead. So it's not, there's something really odd about what they just throw these references from the novel, but the structure of the novel doesn't exist. And it is an odd ending because it's not the heroic death that I think they think it is. And I've watched it three times now at the cinema, and it doesn't come across as a heroic death in any of them really. It's certainly stoic about it. Fair enough, he goes out, he's back straight. But that's about
his performance is good, and I think it's potentially one of sort of his strongest performance. And I think that's the thing where the plot and the ideas do let it down, because it isn't, and it is this moment of where you sort of want to go like, oh, he sacrificed himself for everyone, and that's because he is doing it for queen and country, and that's who he is, and it doesn't land. Pathos that you think is going to be rewarded
isn't there. No, and that's a really good point. So the pathos would have been he could have had a life with his wife and daughter, but he chose to sacrifice himself for the world. That's pathos. That's tragic, but it's also heroic. Or he survives, but he can never see his wife and daughter ever again. That's pathos, and that's tragic. But this is some weird mix of both, and it really doesn't work. A one way out of it should have been the virus is going to be spread imminently, and they need to blow it up now, and they need to keep their blast doors open. And the only way the blast doors open is they remain open manually. So basically, he needs to be there holding the switch. Definitely. There's no other way around it. Yes, he won't see his wife and daughter, but there's no other way. The only way, otherwise, this virus is really, millions of people will die, is if he holds it open manually.
And it gives him that crowning moment of he's saving it.
And I don't even like the Batman films, but like in the last Batman, the Dark Knight Rises, whereas he has to take it out into the sea, right, to the bomb that's going to blow up the city.
Yeah.
Or I think that's what happens in
it. Yeah, that's right. The nuclear bomb that's about to go up and he flies off.
It's the sentimentality, I think, for me, and I'll say this elsewhere in the podcast, but it's like, I'm not a big fan of sentimental films anyway. And one of the reasons why I'm a fan of James Bond is because they historically haven't been sentimental. We get it really laid on thick in this film. It's not just one emotional speech we get. It's about six or seven, or five or six. We get the right at the start with saying, I miss you, to Vesper's grave. Okay, fair enough. Then we get the stuff with Felix dying, right? Which is the bit where I felt most sad in the entire film, right? So we get that, fair enough, Felix is dying. Yeah. Then we get the big I love you speech, I shouldn't have put you on the train in Norway, right? Then we get the drawn out death speech, which lasts seemingly forever. I mean, it's really cringy stuff. Then as soon as he's dead, we get M's bit. then we get another bit with the, I'm going to tell you about a man called Bond, James Bond, right at the very end. I mean, any one of those things would have been okay. Two, right? Okay. But by the end, I was really, first time watching it, and second time watching it, I was really done with it.
Right.
Third time, it's coming. It's fingers in my ears and it's finished. I can just try and enjoy the rest of it. And I enjoyed it more the third time than I have any other time.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, isn't it? When thinking about the pulpness and just the entertainment quality of Bond, it is that thing where everyone has a favourite for different reasons and you can watch them again and again and again. And I haven't revisited Spectre. I probably will watch this one again. But I remember watching Casino Royale and watched it loads of times. Even with Quantum of Solace. Cracking first like half an hour. Yeah. Then you can tell there are issues and that's why it goes wrong with writers. And then it gets... But it is, and I know, if it's on TV, I'll watch it and kind of go, oh, that will be entertaining. And it's 1:40?
Yeah.
This is 2:40?
Yeah, more than that, I think. 2:45, and then
And that's the thing. It's just in terms of just a piece of entertainment. I think it's just weighed down by, like you say, the sentimentality and needing, or this drive to need more and be better than the last and improving upon it. And is that because that's where we are now? Or is that because in order to be better than Pierce Brosnan, you have to have a class actor? In order to be better than the last director, you have to have an Oscar-winning director? To be better than an Oscar-winning film with an Oscar winning, like, everything, you need to have bigger, you need to have Ralph Fiennes in it.
Yeah,
you had Judi Dench, now you've got Ralph Fiennes.
You can't have an unknown actor.
You can't, no. So what, and then obviously this is a big question, is the what's next? Everyone's seen after the title, what after the credits, sorry, what's said.
Yeah,
but does it now have to be soft reboot, or does it have to be, because I can't imagine you're allowed to go, well, you can do whatever you want to, people are allowed. But the idea of having Ralph Fiennes in it as M and going, this is a new James Bond, because James Bond's coming back, feels wrong to me. So it feels like you'd have to do another reboot like Casino Royale, but that's been done.
Yeah.
Everyone's tired of origin stories. So do, like, in a way, could this be an exercise in going, it has to be pulp, but it has to be a more throwaway thing because people are done. A bit like how Batman, at the moment, you're going to have a version with Michael Keaton coming out. You've got Robert Pattinson. You've got all the different versions. So does it go, actually, this is our opportunity to make it for different people?
Mm-hmm.
Which would be quite exciting because you it's the position you put yourself in. And then you get the chance to go, like, I mean, I don't know. I'm not quite sure with Amazon buying MGM, if they own James Bond now, it's its own separate entity, what the sort of wranglings are there. But I'd certainly like, you know, you could see, I don't know, remember in the 90s, James Bond Jr.
Mm-hmm.
This would be the chance to go and go, like, actually, it could be bigger. We can do, this is the adult one. This is the pulpy one. This is the kids one. This is, like, but if they do that.
Yeah, I mean, I hope they don't. I mean, I saw somebody say, basically, like, yeah, Star Wars is basically a TV show now, right? I mean, it's just all the gravitas of Star Wars has been pissed away,
yeah,
quite frankly, right? And so I hope they don't go down that route. I think there's no well. I heard it's expressed this way, in that every time the James Bond films have gone too far in terms of the science fiction and the scale, the very next film scales down. So from You Only Live Twice to On Her Majesty's Secret Service, from Moonraker to For Your Eyes Only, from Die Another Day to Casino Royale, and I think rather than go off in terms of science fiction, they've pushed it in terms of the emotional storytelling. There's literally nowhere for them to go. You can't kill his wife. We've already done that again. We've done that, you know, with Vesper. No, he's not his wife, but Vesper and Trace. We can't kill Felix immediately anyway because he's already gone. Can't call M because we did it in Skyfall. Can't even kill James Bond anymore. And, you know, they've pushed it so far, there's literally nowhere for it to go in terms of that. What was your favourite bit about it then? We'll wrap this up.
Favourite bit. I think
that wasn't supposed to be a hard question.
No, I know. I think a lot of people have obviously enjoyed the Cuba scene.
Uh-huh.
I think that does have just... That's the fun, pulpy, throwaway... He's being great.
Mm-hmm.
There is him wearing the tux. And again, it's things like that where you are talking about the iconic James Bond. Walks into the gun barrel, turns around, shoots from the hip, blood comes down. That's Bond.
Mm-hmm.
The music and that scene gives you that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, whilst it is the one that a lot of people are saying, it's for good reason. The chase sequence and seeing the Aston Martins, all enjoyable. Again, because it's the icon that you know. Everyone's going to James Bond to see James Bond. As much as they want to reinvent it, if you reinvent it too far, it won't be James Bond anymore. People are still turning up every couple of years for a reason. And as soon as that gets twisted, manipulated too much, that audience won't stay faithful.
Will, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks very much to Will. And I want to reiterate my thanks to all the guests, Lee Kenny, Chris Deasy and Will Hill. I really appreciate their time. I also want to thank you for listening. Newton Talks will return.